This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States has always supported dictators in the Congo, but now Washington is acting like it wants to oust the guy it put in power. Mumia Abu-Jamal says the tide is turning against barbaric medical practices in U.S. prisons. And we'll have a conversation with two Black authors who claim reparations for slavery is a dead issue. But first, reparations remains on the agenda of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, which will hold a national conference at Chicago State University, August 12th and 13th. It's the 8-year-old coalition's first national conference outside the East Coast. Cam Howard is the point person on reparations for Black is Back. He's also chairman of the Legislative Commission of NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
I think Chicago will be very receptive to the Black is Back Coalition's message. Chicago has been a politically active locale for a long time when it comes to Black politics in America, with the last big push of building a president from Chicago. But even with that, we have entered into an era of political organizing around self-determination. I think there's a big push toward outing some of the current political leaders, not only nationally, but also here in Chicago. There's a lot of pushback coming toward elected officials right now. So it's a very good time for the Black is Back Coalition to have an event dealing with the electoral system here in Chicago at this time.
Yes, of course, the Black is Back Coalition has put out a national Black agenda on self-determination that could be useful in Chicago.
Oh, most definitely it can be useful, and it is being used right now. The Black is Back Coalition's national convention is entitled The Ballot and the Bullet, Elections, War and Peace in the Era of Donald Trump. And part of our reason for utilizing that title is because our people have been so enamored with the electoral system, and so we came together as a coalition to see how we can interject the historical struggle for self-determination via or within the electoral. One of the issues in our self-determination agenda is reparations, and how we're pushing that here in Chicago is a Black is Back led push to have a reparations referendum put on the Chicago ballot in March of 2018. So we're utilizing the self-determination platform of the Black is Back very mightily here in Chicago.
What's the process of getting a referendum on reparations?
Well, here in Chicago, there's been a law since 2000 that mandates that corporations that want to do business with the city must disclose their relationship to the enslavement, profits, investments of our ancestors. And that law is being honored 100%, but it's being honored. However, after disclosing, that's all they have to do. So we determined that we were going to create a referendum to amend the slavery disclosure ordinance, mandating that in addition to disclosure, there must also be some type of contribution into a reparations fund. And the process is that we need 8% of registered voters in the city of Chicago who voted in the last gubernatorial election, signatures of 8%, which would amount to about 40,000 signatures. If we get 40,000 signatures of registered voters in the city of Chicago to petition that this question goes on the ballot, it would then go on the ballot for the March 20th primary, and the people would get a chance to vote on whether or not these corporations and institutions, billion-dollar corporations, billion-dollar institutions with billion-dollar endowments like the University of Chicago, Rush Medical College, and others here in Chicago, whether or not they'll be forced to not only disclose, but also to pay into a reparations fund.
So you're hoping that this Black is Back conference can be a part of gearing up to get those 40,000 signatures and then to campaign for the referendum.
That's exactly right. We're doing this stealthily underground because we don't want to alert the powers that be. but we're coming out in the open at the Black is Back conference in Chicago, and we hope that we'll get many, many, many volunteers to assist us in getting these signatures.
What kind of political consensus is there in Black Chicago around reparations?
Well, Black Chicago mirrors the United States. Most people you ask are in favor of it, but few are willing to work for them. And so we see this as a way to get people involved with the reparations movement without having them to expend a lot of time. They can come out on any day at a particular event and put 3 hours into canvassing for signatures. And so we think this action will bring more involved in the reparations movement, as well as further the goals and agenda of the movement.
We're talking about the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. Obviously, reparations has a lot to do with social justice, but what does it have to do with peace?
Well, that's a good question, Brother Glenn. We live in Chicago. I was out of town from the last weekend of June. I came back. There were 42 shootings in the city of Chicago that weekend. The 4th of July weekend, I think there were over 80-something shootings. So there's a lot of violence in our community that's directly resulted to the crimes committed against our ancestors, both historically and currently. Ongoing crimes against our humanity, from enslavement, Jim Crow segregation, the subprime lending, which just exacerbated the wealth in the Black community, has led to the degradation of the Black community, the locking out Black men from employment opportunities out of the workforce. All these things result of crimes that have been committed against us as a people. All these are reflective of the crimes that have been committed against us and are ongoing. And so reparations are due for those crimes. And that's the way that we feel that it would impact, or that violence is a direct result of these injuries.
Now, this conference is going to be at Chicago State University. What other organizations in Chicago, besides those that are directly affiliated with the Black is Back Coalition, do you expect to see represented?
Well, we have the Chicago Alliance Against Racial and Political Repression. They're the Chicago chapter of the National Alliance Against Racial and Political Repression, a anti-imperialist group. They have been pushing in Chicago the Civilian Police Accountability Council, which is a community-controlled police law that they've been pushing for about 4.5 years. We've been working with them on that push for Civilian Police Accountability Council. They will be represented by one of their longtime field reps. Frank Chapman will be there, and we'll bring them in. We are looking to have Impedum, of course, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, will be there with us. We're looking to get some representatives from the Black Youth Project 100, bring our youth in. And we have also the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Some of their members have confirmed that they will be in attendance. This marks a new era, man, in political consciousness among our people. Malcolm said it best, the ballot or the bullet, that we will attempt to use the political process to make gains, to demand that we're treated fairly and equitably across the board. But if not, you know, we have to, you know, utilize other means. And while we're watching this nation expand its war machinery across the globe, we can't look at that and say, you know, it's okay for them to do it, and we're sitting back idly on our hands just waiting for the powers that be to do the right thing.
That was Cam Howard of the Black is Back Coalition speaking from Chicago. Dr. Jahi Issa and Reggie Mabry authored a recent article in Black Agenda Report in which they laid out what they believe is a new legal strategy to gain reparations for Black people in the United States. Jahi and Mabry contend that current reparations efforts will never be accepted by the U.S. courts, and that, for the time being, reparations is dead. We spoke first with Dr. Issa.
When we say reparations is dead, it's been 10 years since the United States Supreme Court has thrown out the last major reparations suit, and there has yet to be any argument or details as to why we lost this suit and what we need to do to move forward. This is yet to be brought to the community, the greater community. And so I think Brother Reggie Marbury can talk a bit more about why it's dead.
As Dr. Issa said, the reparations case died with the Deirdre Farmer Pellman case in 2006 with the opinion of Judge Posner. And as Dr. Issa said, it's been about 10 or 11 years since anyone has even talked about the damage that the Posner opinion said. Our analysis is that the case was noble and well fought by many, but the problem is with the case that it attacked the wrong defendants and misidentified the wrong victims. And this is where our argument begins. Our argument begins as one is that simply, fortunately, slavery in the United States was immoral, but it was legal. It was immoral, but it was legal in the United States laws. What was not legal was in 1807, the United States and others ended the transatlantic slave trade. From 1807 to the Civil War, they are human trafficking illegally Africans into the United States. And what does this mean? This means that the victims are Africans coming in from 1807 to the Civil War, right? And who are the defendants? The defendants are the states and their instruments, their corporate instruments that are allowing this to happen. Unfortunately, the Deirdre Farmer case, the defendants were bankers. And unfortunately, at this time, slavery was legal, bankers and insurers. The victims were victims that were legally enslaved because they did not specify. So I'll stop right there.
Well, if the international slave trade was illegal in the U.S. after 1807, that, I guess, lets the U.S. government off the hook, while you say the states and others are still liable under U.S. law.
Slavery was in fact, but the problem was is that they were human trafficking Africans, and that was illegal. So what the United States did was any Africans coming into the shore, and there were millions of Africans coming into the United States shores, as soon as they got to the shores, they were labeled as slaves, so then it was legal. So all they had to do was get these Africans to the shores of the United States, and then these Africans had no rights. So what we're saying is that we have primary evidence to show that the United States courts, the Supreme Justices, members of the court, even presidents of the United States, know that they were illegally moving Africans from Africa into the Americas. And then what they did not do is they did not change the rights or look at the rights of these Africans.
I would like to add that these are sovereign African nationals from African kingdoms. They're not slaves, right? And they never gave up their citizenship to the nation states in which they were illegally kidnapped from. And I use the word kidnapped because this is the word that is used by the United States Supreme Court in the Amistad case. These were African nationals that were brought here to the United States against U.S. law and international law.
But those Africans who in the centuries before 1807 were also kidnapped, were also taken from sovereign states and did not acquiesce in their citizenship, nationality in those sovereign states be taken away?
We have to understand, well, first, let's just deal with the United States laws. Let's not deal with the Spanish or any other groups, the Dutch or anybody else, or even the British. We only have to deal with the United States laws. From 1776 to 1807 is roughly 41 years. So we have 41 years and we have 13 colonies. Africans, of course, were coming in. They were here prior. But the problem is for 41 years, we're looking at the United States. In that 41 years, we only have 13 colonies. Becoming 13 states. There was no need for the millions of Africans because you did not have Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. You didn't have those big southern states. They were not in the Union yet, right? So the issue is, yes, there were Africans here. And yes, those Africans integrated with the new Africans coming in, right? But what we're doing is we have to make sure we told things correct inside law, right? So at some point, they become descendants of both groups, right? Descendants of both groups, and none of them have lost their sovereignty. So I'm hoping that I'm making it clear that Africans integrated with new Africans coming in 1807, but the bulk of the Africans coming into the states as they become the Union of the United States are new Africans, and most of the Africans are coming, all of the Africans are coming 1807 to the end of the Civil War, when it was supposed to be legal. So you have more than 3 to 10 million Africans, because many of them are dying in the first 2 years of what they call seasoning, coming into the United States. And we have millions of more coming into the Caribbean and into Brazil as holding spots to secretly sneak them into the United States through Florida and South Carolina. So what we're looking at is a federal conspiracy. And this is what we are uncovering, that these states were involved in this because they brought in new slaves. So we're talking about after the Louisiana Purchase, after Haiti and the Louisiana Purchase, we have all this new land that needs slaves. And they did not get those slaves from breeding in the United States. They got them fresh Africans, and we have the proof.
What it appears you're trying to find, seeking, is standing, what lawyers call standing in the U.S. courts for those post-1807 imported Africans, and to extend that standing to the rest of the group.
That is correct. First, one of the burdens that we have to show is we have to show that the United States has never construed the rights of these illegal Africans, these Africans that were illegally imported into the United States. So their rights were never construed. Though we have the Amistad case, they were construed because it was Spanish, right? These captives was on a Spanish ship. But the ones that came in the American ships, like the Wanderer and the Kalita, they were never construed against the Constitution for their rights. Then after that, there is another important issue is to deal with the state conspiracy and the denying of the rights so that we can bring it to court. And then all of these Africans become now, we are descendants of all of these Africans. So we're looking, if we start tolling at 1808, we have Africans like a Booker T. Washington, whose mother was an African. We have a number of prominent figures, Nat Turner, whose mother was an African. So we know that these are all new Africans because the other Africans were dying out and they had to be replenished. So our status comes with when we go to the United States and we say, first of all, you've committed fraud on your court. And that has no statute of limitation, meaning that we could see where you were supposed to construe our rights, but you never did because you falsely labeled us as slaves. Because you had slaves laws. What you did not do is look at our international personality as being sovereigns, as Brother Patrick and Dr. Issa has said, coming from the continent of Africa.
And is this why you're calling folks who came after, from Africa, after 1807, victims of human trafficking, rather than using other words?
We are saying victims of human trafficking, because that's what the United States Supreme Court said it was, right? We have to make this clear. And this is the problem with all of the previous reparations cases. They've had great legal minds, but no properly trained people who understand history, right? And we can't afford another loss, whether it is the study of local slavery, like the bill that Mr. Charles Barnes has in the assembly, or whether it is H.R. 5.
We cannot do the cart before the horse. We have trained academicians, trained lawyers, and researchers. Our politicians are very helpful to pushing our policy to the multitude, but the problem with cases like the Deirdre Farmer Pellman case was it was not done by experts, African human trafficking, or formerly enslavement, because they do not make the distinction between understanding that slavery, in fact, was legal. So their defendants are insurance agencies and stuff, but they were acting because slavery was legal. What they're not talking about is these illegal shipbuilders and the enormous amount of capital that was coming through this process that was then funneled into the states to build these United States.
And also the federal government is also complicit in this. This is why Reggie is saying the Supreme Court, there's fraud on the court. Because on one part, like in the Amistad, but we have other case law, like in the Amistad, where they're saying that the Mende people are a sovereign group of people who did not wage war against the United States. And they were brought to U.S. territory illegally when it was against national law and international law. However, at the same time as the Amistad case, other groups, including federal government agencies and state agencies, are bringing in other sovereign nationals against international law and national law. And this is different. These people are not slaves. And this is the problem with the bill that is in the House Assembly now. They want to talk about slavery. We're not talking about slavery. We are talking about human trafficking. And because they do not have the right people in their committees to make them understand this, then they're setting us up for a loss. And we cannot afford a loss again. We will not allow another loss for people who are representing the group as a whole.
I will add this. Judge Posner, when he came back with his opinion, he said the following things that are very damaging, which is in your important article that you printed for us. He said things like, in all likelihood, it would still be impossible for them to prove injury, requiring as they would connecting the particular slavery transaction in which the defendants were involved in to harm two particular slaves. But in any event, suits complaining about injuries that occurred more than a century ago and half ago have been barred for a long time by the applicable state statutes of limitations. That is one of the things that they're saying. They're saying that what we're continuously doing is resonating formulaic conclusions and feelings without tying it to the victim, the exact victim, to the exact defendant. And the courts are very prepared now after this Posner and after this decision called Twombly-Iqbal, which basically says that all a plaintiff needs is factual allegations to provide grounds for his entitlement of relief, but it has to go past mere labels and conclusions. So if it does not go through mere labels and conclusions tying the exact victim to the exact defendant, then that will not nudge it past, and it will be, how can I say, dismissed under something called 12b6 motion to dismiss. So after the Posner decision, what Posner did was set us up. What if he come in court with these labels and conclusions and these formulaic things like they stole us, they owe us. Whoa. That's what we really believe. We really believe that because they stole us, they owe us. American law does not say that. American law says slavery was in fact legal. But we have to be more precise to say that they stole us after 1807, right? So it was not legal, right? Your states received these slaves. You violated United States law. You conspired, right? So that these people that you did violate their sovereignty, you in fact now owe them remedies. You have to construe their rights against the courts. So we have to be much more precise than just simply talk about, oh, slavery. They are well prepared for us. And so that's why we're calling for a body of experts, because this has to be the new black agenda. We cannot settle for speeches. We have great speeches. We need dialogue. So I come from a house called Black News 102. We debate all the time, but we need a national debate. So the next issue that we put up before the courts, it has to have a national audience.
clearly you're tailoring your approach in order to get standing in the U.S. court system. But does this approach actually excite black people rather than muddy the waters? And what does it say to those who are part of the movement that declares slavery a crime against humanity, which also has no statute of limitations?
And that's a very good question, right? We believe that what we have will excite black America, because what we are looking at is the official account is 800,000 Africans who were brought from 1807, 1808, up into the Civil War. We think it's triple that amount, right? Also, this also leads to another very important issue. Again, this is not slavery. These are sovereign Africans. We have records that show that these sovereign Africans, even up until the 1930s, were begging the United States government to send them back to their sovereign kingdoms. And we're talking about millions, potentially millions of people and their descendants. If that doesn't excite black people, what else will? Right? And so we are asking for a public discourse versus on the issues versus human trafficking and slavery. And we already know that slavery has no standing whatsoever in federal court.
Well, I'll add, first of all, we don't have to be emotional about this. Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave master, Madison, a president of the United States, associate judge of the Supreme Court, Joseph Story, all said that the importation of slaves is a crime against humanity. It's already said by people of this government. So we're speaking with authority. So we're not speaking with emotion. And they are specifically talking about the illegal slave trade happening from this period, 1808. The United States officials say this, and this is going to be problematic. They're going to say that slavery in itself is not a sin. There has been slavery throughout all history. They will cite even the biblical. They will cite that. And we don't necessarily disagree. Slavery in itself is not a sin because it gives an opportunity of people to work it out and to fix it. They could be prisoners of war. However, what the United States officials in this government say that it is, in fact, the importation of Africans that was the sin. And we have that in writing. So if that doesn't excite people, see, what should excite people is history. History, it should qualify our research. That's what it does. So the history and the right things, the hidden gems, don't excite you like treasures. Then you are a fool. If you don't understand the difference between fool's gold and gold, right? Then you are a fool. What we're offering different than all the other scholars, only because we changed the rules. The rules that we're changing is that it's not about slavery. It's about the illegal African human trafficking after 1807, where states themselves violated their law. So we're not against those who say slavery is not a crime of humanity. We're just offering better research.
That was Reggie Mabry, along with Dr. Jaki Issa. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, took the Pennsylvania prison system to court for failure to treat him and thousands of other inmates with hepatitis C, and he won twice. The mass black incarceration state continues its barbaric medical practices, but Abu-Jamal says the tide is turning.
When our recent hepatitis C case was decided January 3rd, 2017, we thought that the state, known widely for its repressive penal attitudes and its cold resistance to the principle that prisoners were, after all, human beings entitled to the rights, privileges, and protections inherent in human personality, would be deeply impacted. We were correct, in a sense. For the case Abu-Jamal versus Wetzel did indeed change the legal rules of the game, at least on paper. In practice, however, the fiendish protocol, first announced in the December 2015 hearings in our case, which stubbornly demands that people who are infected with a hepatitis C virus must be at death's door before even being considered for possible treatment, remains to this day to be DOC's practice and procedure, despite being found unconstitutional twice. But beyond Pennsylvania's archaic frontiers, the case is making ripples in the lives of thousands of other prisoners who are suffering the ravages of Hep C or HCV, like in the state of Missouri, where prisoners Michael Prostosky, Christopher Baker, and Michael Jamerson filed the class action suit against the Missouri Department of Corrections, or MDOC, claiming inadequate medical care for their HCV viral infections and the refusal of MDOC and Corizon Incorporated, MDOC's health care provider, to treat plaintiffs with a direct-acting antiviral known to resolve and actually cure HCV in a timely manner. When MDOC officials filed their motions to dismiss the case, the U.S. District Court in Missouri's Western District granted their motion in part, but also denied a huge chunk of their motions, finding that the prisoner plaintiffs had indeed shown a serious medical need, HCV, that MDOC defendants showed deliberate indifference to their medical needs, and that the plaintiffs had shown a reasonable probability of success on the merits of their complaint. To do this, the court used the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent on medical issues called Estelle versus Gamble, a 1976 case, and the recent Abu Jamal decision of January 2017. Because of that medical precedent, the lives of thousands of men and women in Missouri prisons just got better, and their lives were extended and perhaps saved. We have little doubt that the medical and corporate interest denying medical treatment here and there will continue to drag their feet and deny relief. But a dam has burst, and the dike has sprung, and HCV is under serious attack. The HCV prison wars have begun, and we are winning.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, reporting for Prison Radio. 2 million people have been displaced by violence in the Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Untold numbers have been killed, with many bodies found in mass graves. According to Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo, it's no coincidence that vast quantities of precious minerals have also been discovered in the Kasai region.
It's coltan, lithium, and cobalt. And the media, unfortunately, of course, have been not connecting the displacement and the discovery of the minerals, because either is journalism dishonesty, may not know how to really explain why they're not covering that. But the reality is that for over a year now, people in the center of the Congo, the Kasai region, have suffered tremendously. We've now discovered 80 mass graves with bodies of people. So I'm not saying 80 people dead. I'm talking about 80 mass graves. A mass grave does not just have one or two bodies. We're talking about dozens of bodies in the mass grave. And these killings have been attributed in the latest report to some of the government forces clearly assaulting the civilians. And there are documentation of that, where earlier this year, a leaked video of the Congolese military shooting at civilians was released. The New York Times published the unedited version of the Congolese military filming how they were killing the civilians. So one will ask, why is the Congolese military shooting civilians, killing them, and actually filming themselves? Well, what people need to know is that this is something that the Congolese president has asked his military. And he has asked his military to film their military campaigns to actually prove that they are doing the work on the ground. So with the Kasai massacres that's taking place right now, it is important really for people to know this is not the first time this has happened in the Congo. The conflict in the Congo has taken the lives of 6 million people. And the same region that we are discussing about, we can go back 100 years from now. This is the same area where King Leopold II of Belgium caused the deaths of millions of Congolese again, in that same exact area. So 100 years ago, in that area, it was cop robbers they were getting. Now, 100 years later is cobalt, lithium, and coltan they are getting. But the international press has gotten into the issue also because in the massacre that took place there, two young investigators from the UN were sent to actually come up with evidence that indeed in that area there are people who are being killed because they have been reporting of the mass graves. As these two young investigators went to the Kasai region in March of 2017, they were killed. One of them, Michael Sharp from Kansas, is working in Congo. His work actually also in Germany. He's done a lot of work around conflict resolutions. He's been really working also with Congolese communities before becoming a UN investigator. He was killed. He's an American. And the other person who was killed is Aida Catalan from Sweden. The two went there to put pressure on the UN in bringing up evidence about what was happening, and unfortunately they died. So there have been a lot of push around making sure that the truth comes out about who is responsible for the deaths and also the deaths of Congolese there. But as a human rights activist who has been following the situation in the Congo for a decade now, consistently, and with the evidence that has come out from RFE, it is clear that the deaths of civilians in the Kasai regions, hundreds of them, we have already found, we can say even thousands of them in these mass graves, have been caused by the Congolese government killing. And then the killing of Azaida Catalan and Michael Sharp, I could also claim the same. But we need an investigation actually into what has happened so that the people who have committed the crime could be found and could be brought to justice. So that's on one level. But the challenge now of the situation in Kasai, because it's happening in a context. It's happening in a context where there is a political impasse in the Congo where Joseph Kabila, who I can say today is the former president of the Congo, who has latched onto power beyond his term limits, has refused to organize presidential elections at the end of his second term. The way I could explain that is that, can you imagine the president of the United States, after his two terms, right? The U.S. president can only have two terms. After his second term, decides not to organize election and wait till after November of his second term, at the end of his second term to say, well, let's see what we can do about organizing another election. We still intend to run for a third term when the U.S. Constitution doesn't say so. So this is the context in which that we are doing that.
Now, Kabila says that he's not trying to run for a third term, but there can't be elections until he holds a census to count how many Congolese there are and where they live, and that census would take 18 months to organize, and that he needs to stay there in the interim.
And this actually is preposterous. And he just did another interview with a German newspaper where they asked him the same question. And this was his response. He has never promised to the Congolese people that he will organize the elections. So what we are seeing with Kabila, the real issue of Kabila is to put the historical context of how long he's been in power. He's been in power for over 16 years, but we'll break it down. The first time he came into power, I call that a coup d'etat. Laurent Désiré Kabila was assassinated, and then he ascended to power. Congo had laws. When the so-called son of the president, when the president died, the son of the president does not become the president. That's the reality in DRC, but somehow he became the president. So I call that a military coup d'etat, which was backed by the United States because the United States recognized him as the next president. Just as when there was a coup in Venezuela against Hugo Chavez, the U.S. was the first country to recognize that rogue government of power. The same thing happened with Joseph Kabila taking power in 2001. So from 2001 to 2006, he was the president of the so-called transition in the country. So I call that we gave him a free pass. Take that time, whatever you need to do, stay in power. In 2006, he organized an election which at the end of the presidential election, Kabila was declared the winner. The international community has always presented it as he won it fair and square. But what I remember about 2006 is that Congolese people died in the street protesting the results. So 2006, he gets his first presidential term. The U.S. still sees him as an ally. And actually, the U.S. embassy organized a party for him in 2006. That's what people do not know, with the executives of Freeport-McMoRan, a U.S. Mining company. So we know that the U.S. wanted him to win that 2006 election. 5 years later, Congo's constitution said that the president has a five-year term limit. 5 years after that, the second election is organized, which if he won, he would be there for his last term. He was declared again the winner of the 2011 election. Massive protest inside and outside. The entire world knew that we had a sham election, that Kabila did not win that presidential election. So take a wild guess which country was the first country to recognize a fraudulent election. The United States was the first country to recognize Kabila as the president of the Congo on February 15, 2012. So the election took place in December of 2011, but it took them 2 months, and the entire so-called international community was waiting on the U.S. position because everyone was unclear. Would the United States support Kabila or not? Because Congolese were organizing and mobilizing to have people around the world not to recognize that those fraudulent elections, but the U.S. did. As soon as the U.S. recognized him, he received legitimacy around the world, and Western nations continued to support him at the time. So from 2012 to 2016, Kabila wants the world to believe that he did not have the resources to organize presidential elections, that today, in 2017, months after the deadline of his presidency, that he needs more time to organize it. So what I will put forth is, if Kabila cannot organize presidential election in 5 years, he is not adequate to organize elections in 18 months. So he should step away. And that should not be even a discussion. The reason why I'm saying that should not be a discussion is the Congolese constitution is clear that the president of the Congo can only be president for 2 presidential terms, and that the presidential term limits cannot be amended.
But the United States has now switched, apparently, on Mr. Kabila and is actively working to undermine him.
That is true, that the United States government has definitely shifted policy on the Kabila regime. But we have to also put that in context. The U.S. is only looking for the interests of the United States government. While I'll say I'll applaud U.S. effort to challenge the Kabila regime on the arrest of young people, on the mistreatment of civilians, on asking him to step down, I'm very clear that Kabila will not have been here today if the U.S. did not support him in 2012, on February 15, 2012. So I'm clear about that position. But the effect of the U.S. switching side is that Kabila is actually playing, using it in his favor, in presenting himself as a so-called Pan-African leader, an African leader who's being attacked by the imperialist.
Yes, Kabila is now invoking the name of Patrice Lumumba every chance he gets.
And I'm sure wherever the soul of our hero, Patrice Lumumba, is, must be screaming that someone such as Kabila will even speak about Kimpanvinta and other leaders of the Congo. But I'm very clear, and that's why the challenge of the narrative is what? Because it's not just about U.S. interest and also what Kabila government is doing. It is very important for African peoples and oppressed people around the world to be very clear about what's happening in the DRC, that the Congolese people are caught in a vicious circle whereby people who need Congo's resources are doing everything in their power for Congolese to not be free. So on one hand, the Congolese people are fighting to make sure that Kabila does not stay in power. Of course, an election does not solve every issue, but they're seeing that as a beginning of something new. If the Congolese people are successful of having a representative government, that will transform the Congo, the region, and the entire African continent. So when you know that this is a reality that will happen to the Congolese people, and you are a Western power, you want to make sure that when that transformational change happens in DRC, in the Congo, that the new leaders coming in are leaders who will serve U.S. interest. So that's the vicious circle.
You have said on a number of occasions that the United States is actively, through its agencies and the spreading around of money, trying to co-opt the opposition to Kabila in Congo, and especially to co-opt young people.
And this is also what has caused the weakening of some of the movements on the ground. The reason being is many youth now are paranoid about who is who on the ground. Whenever they learn about what has happened in Latin America, specifically when we look at what happened in Colombia or Venezuela, when Hugo Chavez was in power, we remember very vividly as young Congolese that the National Endowment for Democracy funded those who did the coup. And we saw how all the so-called opposition leaders in Venezuela who were trying to destabilize Venezuela were funded by the West. So that model is now happening on the African continent. And what the youth have understood now is they see that they are getting close to liberate the country. They're understanding now the challenges. They're seeing the same organization coming in. They're seeing USAID. They're seeing National Endowment for Democracy. They're seeing all these institutions coming in. But from a very interesting perspective, that the first thing they are trying to offer is financial resources. Because they do know that youth movement on the ground do not have the financial resources sometimes needed to organize. So they offer that. And it's very small group of organizations who are saying no to that, who believe that they can organize without these financial resources being provided there. But what is the effect of that? The same thing that I'm saying now about what these institutions are doing to infiltrate youth movement, the Congolese government has the same information. So what they are now doing is they are attacking youth movement indiscriminately. They're presenting youth movement in DRC as these are U.S.-funded organizations. The U.S. government is behind them. They are the one actually coming to cause chaos. And because the information of this institution can be easily found, when you see a youth group in Congo flying into Washington and speaking on Capitol Hill, and you see who brought that organization from Congo to the United States, it's clear for any government official in DRC to connect the dots about who is supporting some of the youth movement. So that's creating also tension amongst the different groups who are organizing for change on the ground. But let me also be clear. While I'm saying that this is creating tension in others, people on the outside who hear the usual name of so-called Congolese youth movement in international media, they should be very aware that these movements are not the mass movements in the DRC. Why do I say that? The people who are fighting on the ground, they're fighting with the dispossessed. They're fighting with the people who don't even speak English or French, who speak the native tongue, who won't change and who are organizing. They are not on Twitter. They are not on Facebook. They don't have access to media. They don't get the press in their organizing. And that's the narrative. As I'm looking at what young Congolese are doing on the ground, this is the similar narrative that I saw in Egypt. While there were some groups who had media access, and there were the ones who were really on the ground doing the work, who you will never hear from. And that was like the popular mass that actually created the change in Egypt. And I'm seeing the same also happening in the DRC.
It's ironic. The Obama administration champions Kabila and propped him up and then later turned against him. And now Kabila is spending millions of dollars in order to woo the new Republican government by hiring Republican lobbyists to represent its interests in Washington.
$5.6 million is the tab. You know, the Congolese government has put forward $5.6 million to lobby the United States government. So on one hand, the so-called anti-imperialists are coming to Washington to tell Washington, please keep us in power. But what is actually unfolding? The context is that the Congolese government hired a security firm. It's based out of Israel. So this corporation received $5.6 million to represent the Kabila government, and they are the ones hiring the lobby firm in Washington, D.C. They have hired Bado, the former Republican senator, who is one of the first surrogates of Donald Trump. And they've hired many more lobbyists who have been paid with the money that has come in. But what is he trying to achieve? He actually believes that with the lobbies that he has, he can convince the Trump administration to actually not continue the policy that Obama started toward the end of his term. And the policy that Obama started was to use diplomacy to remove the so-called strong man. And he was not actually very active to try to remove him before he left the White House. So will he be successful? To me, I don't think that it really matters what Kabila does in Washington, how much money spends with the lobbyists there. The final say is going to be in the street of Kinshasa with the youth of the Congo who are taking it to the streets, who are being arrested, who are being killed on a daily basis, and people don't hear about them, and they have been organizing. And what will now also make an impact, while the Congolese youth doesn't have 5.6 million, they want their story to be told on the outside, to provide a counter-narrative that we have Bado, who is literally whitewashing Kabila's murder. Kabila has committed so many crimes. He has caused, or actually even ordered, the killing of civilians in Kasai. 2 million people have been displaced. I mean, I'm saying that just as a term. I mean, imagine, this is a city. 2 million people have been removed from their homes because they are running away from the fight. And it's important for people who live in the United States to be clear about who supports the so-called strong men in Africa, because it's always presented as, look at these leaders, they are corrupt, they're destroying the communities. But no one is talking about the so-called American counterparts who are running in Washington to try to present these dictators as the good leader for democracy in Africa.
It's very interesting. The high-priced lobbyists that Kabila has hired are telling legislators on Capitol Hill that Kabila is a good guy because he's fighting Islamic extremism in Congo, which has proportionately very few Muslims. And that's the same line that's being run by Paul Kagame, the dictator of neighboring Rwanda, who also says that he's fighting Islamic extremism in a country that's 95% Christian.
I mean, they're learning it from the best. You know, when the American corporations who benefited from the first war in Iraq got the PR line of bombs of mass destruction, even Colin Powell told a lie at the UN. So we are very used to that. And it's quite stunning. I mean, imagine, right? You just say a country that is 95% Christian, the president of the Congo is saying that there are Muslim extremists who are there and needs the U.S. support. I don't think that's the extremism that we need to worry about. We don't need to worry about Muslim extremism in DRC. What we need to worry about is U.S. backing dictators who are extremists, who are killing their own civilians, and then let her come and try to be at the right side of the people and not taking accountability for their actions because when they don't take accountability for their actions, these behaviors will continue. The reason why Patrice Lumumba was assassinated was because the CIA ran an operation and created a propaganda machine to label Patrice Lumumba a communist who will give Congo's resources to Russia, and they eliminated him under the Eisenhower presidency. The same thing now, the same lie they're saying about Patrice Lumumba is the same lie now they're saying about the Congolese people, that a country of 95% Christian have so-called Muslim extremism. What I call extremism is finding 100 mass graves in the Kasai. What I call extremism is to have a young lady named Sephora, who's the vice president of a youth league of a political party in DRC. She's in her 20s. Sephora has been in jail since December of 2016, and we are now in July, almost 7 months. And she was pregnant when she was arrested, and she had a miscarriage, and they're still keeping her in jail. That's extremism. Extremism is people disappearing for just speaking their minds. But that's not what the lobbyists are saying. What the lobbyists are saying in Washington is that Kabila, not an extremist, is trying to fight extremism in DRC, and that needs to be exposed.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.